Welcome everyone to What the Force, and welcome to Andor Declassified, the 11th episode, Daughter of Ferrix. And with me for this and every other episode is my good friend and yours, Alex Kane. Welcome back, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
Daughter of Ferrix. This one was written by Tony Gilroy and directed by Benjamin Caron, who also directed episode 7 and also directs episode 12. So definitely important people involved in this episode. Tony Gilroy adding his own particular vision of the world with writing this particular episode. What did you think about it?
It felt like episode 7, now that you say that. It is kind of
an in-between. It's a bridge episode in a way, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That makes a lot more sense to hear that it's kind of, that 7 was the sort of aftermath of, Aldani and all that stuff. Right. And so, yeah, we get more of that, like, you know, meanwhile on Ferrix kind of, aftermath feel. And, we get, all the chess pieces kind of moving closer to, probably a really dark and explosive 12th episode, I'm guessing. We can get to that.
I mean, so if we look at this story as a complete unit, so we're talking about 24 episodes back to back to back. The lowest point will be at the end of episode 12.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, or sometime during episode 12. And I mean, if they're good, they'll have some sort of hope of tomorrow at the end. You know, I think that that's necessary to want people to come back, or they could just leave us with a cliffhanger for however long it takes them to actually do what they need to do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In that vein, I kind of feel that seeing Cassian and Melchi at the start of the episode hanging off a cliff is semi-foreshadowing for where they may leave us at the end of the season. You know, Melchi and Cassian barely hanging on and sort of looking for any sign of hope that they might be actually safe, that they might have the ability to actually continue on. Which is sort of exactly where you would expect to see Cassian in this moment, that he's on the edge of death, but is able to pull himself up and continue on his journey home. This is like the return, you know? Yeah. He's on the way home back to the world that he had left before.
Yeah. Yeah. You get that sort of like, give me the strength to hope, or like, give me like a whisper of a prayer kind of thing, because, you know, he basically says like, I can't climb any higher, basically, which there's that like climb metaphor again. Like he basically says like, I'm done. And then they're like watching the, what is it? Like the Thai, Reaper or something, like fly by. It's sort of like, tell me they've left. And then it's like, they're gone.
Just some sort of hope that the universe is actually with them, not against them. Yeah. You know, that sort of thing. Like it's kind of like you're crawling out of a hole and you're looking for daylight, like that sort of thing. And that's exactly symbolically what is happening in such a non-direct symbolic way, which is great. You know, we flash back to Ferrix. We flash back to Ferrix and we see a very sad state of affair at the Andor residence. We see it's all alluded to. They don't ever directly say, which is really interesting, that Marva has died.
Yeah, it's very The Last Picture Show, which is an important movie for, I don't know, like a lot of people are really fond of that movie. Peter Bogdanovich, who made that movie, died like a year ago. And a lot of filmmakers, including Rian Johnson, sort of said, you know, that movie was a big deal for me. And it uses the same sort of device where we don't sort of see death as like this big event that happens on screen. It's like, you know, you get it through the community. You get sort of like the people acting the way they do, I guess, when somebody dies. And it's beautifully done. And it's sort of like you experience it the way that someone who just sort of lives on Ferrix might experience it, or somebody who's, you know, knows Cassian, not quite like Cassian because he doesn't know tragically, well, but
they literally just kind of show us, don't tell us what's happening, which is is so beautiful. And it, in so many ways, like there was lots of people that I was like seeing their reactions to this episode. And they there's some people who genuinely think that she's not dead. Like this is all a ruse, you know, of some sort, which, okay, so I want to talk about two things psychologically that are being framed here that are happening. So Marva is our crone in Star Wars, the one female woman crone in Star Wars. There is only one and she's it. So what do crones do for us psychologically? Well, they inspire us, right? They give us the seeds of truth to grow the next generation. They're represented by, you know, people like Baba Yaga, the infamous, you know, Eastern European crone in mythology that, you know, rode around in her pestle and, you know, had a house that was on like chicken legs and had like bones scattered all around her yard and, you know, had the sun and the moon as her servants. Like this is like, you have to think about crones as like all powerful manifestations of womanhood in that they are all goddesses in their powerful form. So if maidens are like not assured with their own power and don't understand what they can do with their own power, mothers or queens are assured of their power, but they spend all their energy trying to grow the kingdom or grow society or grow children, right? Like that's kind of that archetype in the middle. They spend all of their energy kind of focusing on the day-to-day. Crones have been through it all and know all of the power associated with that and understand the power of the intuition. They are the wise warriors from a knowledge perspective, and they no longer give any credence to what people feel about them or what they think, right? So that's when Marva, when she's like, I no longer care what people think. I'm going to do what I need to do. So whatever she embodied needs to live on, right? The daughter of Ferrix, that is Marva. So she, I suspect, set up something with the daughters of Ferrix to help Bix get released and to take down the empire on the planet, right? The crone is such an important symbol, and it's about passing down wisdom to the younger generation as the gift of intuition.
I totally had the thought that like Bix might also be the daughter of Ferrix in the title, kind of like, you know, they had the sort of like Luke and Rey thing with The Last Jedi. It's just like Bix is such a focus in this one and in a couple like the other recent ones too, but you know, you really feel for her in this episode. She's in a tough spot, and so they're building up for her to have a big moment in the next one. So I thought that was
it was her.
A fun title. A little bit too, like that.
It might actually be one of those circumstances where it's both. So how could that be? Well, you know, whatever Marva has set up that passes on her power to the next generation is to save Bix, thus transferring that power to Bix as the maiden character in this certain circumstance. She's literally a maiden trapped in a tower. Like we could see this, right? Like it's there. She's under a curse. Like she's trapped and she has to be rescued. And the only way that can happen is through this mentorship, this knowledge, this aid, this supernatural aid that will be set up by the crone, right? And so important. Being talked to or like cared for, like the daughters of Ferrix require your assistance in a matter of great importance, you know.
I love that.
He's like the way Ferrix treats droids like makes me love this planet even more. It's become like my favorite place in the galaxy. Like it's like
so good. Yeah.
Like, B is important. He's a member of the family and they like treat him as such. And he's sad. And so they're like, you know, do I think that she is still alive? No, I don't. I think she has passed, but that doesn't mean that what she represents will pass.
Yeah, that's where I'm at. I definitely had the question in my head when I was watching the first time, like, you know, is this a trick somehow? I think it's just a device. Like I said, I think that in the Last Picture Show, they're just like, you know, some people are talking and they're like, yeah, you know, Sam the lion died. And then you see kind of like the people's faces when they hear that and just how like sort of quietly devastated they are to hear that this like great figure, you know, passed that they all loved. And so, yeah, I think she's gone and it's just, you know, we're experiencing it through the community's eyes.
Which is almost like such a better way to experience it.
Yeah, rather than like the stereotypical like the heart monitor at the bedside type cliche thing that we see like in every drama or you know, or things like that, just like kind of where it's dramatized a little bit.
There's an absolute truth to how it was represented in that death is not something that it's felt by the people that are left behind. The grief is felt by the people that are left behind. Once you're dead, it's whatever happens to you after you die. It's not, you know, the story is in the characters that have to go on or do what they need to do, you know? And it's such a smart choice to do that way and to trust the audience to feel it correctly, you know, through B's pain.
Yeah, the droid is like so beautifully handled. and yeah, I had like in my notes, just like you were saying, like the brick wall metaphor with the cremation and stuff and how it's like reinforced with the droid. Like every person matters. We all contribute. Like no one gets left behind. This is a collective mission. And like that all...
You've helped make the community stronger. You've helped protect the community. There's always a place for you here. There's so many cool metaphors with the brick.
Yeah. Yeah. Like from, you know, it like it feeds back into the prison stuff a little bit where, you know, they have to work together. But it's also like you have a permanent place here. And I don't know. Like, I feel like that's a rare and beautiful thing when, you know, people feel like, okay, they belong and like, you know, you're not always like looking for where the grass is greener necessarily, but you're kind of investing in that community that has helped you and vice versa.
Yep. And sort of like not to bring this up, but, you know, Cassian ends up becoming Ash, just like Marva in the end.
Right. Yeah. Oof. There's some callbacks to Rogue One in this episode for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're like the show, you know, it's not super self-referential and self-aware all the time and like that winky sort of way, but it does know that the audience knows, you know, that Andor is like the sacrificial figure ultimately. And so, yeah, I like how it kind of works to make that this like peaceful, triumphant thing as opposed to feeling like... You know, it's a shame that, you know, he didn't go on all these other adventures because, you know, now we're finding out he did. And he's a really beautiful character when you explore him beyond just that one movie.
Yes. Yeah. We head back to Cassian and Melchi, who managed to climb up the cliff, probably working together, which was really great. And they spot these two aliens who are, you know, hanging out on the beach, I guess, sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah. They've got a ship, which totally interests them. Did you want to talk about them now?
Oh, sure. I mean, they're sort of like reminiscent of, what's his name? Unkar Plutt from The Force Awakens, right? Like they're kind of like those scrapper type guys, right? Like they're...
I looked them up and they are Suridan aliens and... One of them is Syside Ock, who is listed actually as Dewey Pamular and Freedy, right? Psy-Psy-Doc is actually a member of Saw Gerrera's band faction in Rogue One, but he doesn't go by this in this in Andor, but he looks almost exactly the same from the visual dictionary. I did not find this out. The internet found this out for me. So awesome. But I love them so much.
Yeah.
They're big and sarcastic and adorable, and through their broken language of sort of half sentences and things like that, you find out like they are allies in the dark in so many ways, and they end up like having no love for the Empire, so they're willing to help out these two stranded prisoners.
Yeah, you think like, oh no, like these guys are really bad news, and then they're just kind of like, oh, why didn't you say you were going to smash the Empire? Please take the ship. Something like that. But
Well, they go with them, right? They take them to where they want to go.
Oh, they're taxiing them. Okay. Yeah. That makes more sense. That makes a lot more sense. Yeah. And of course, it's the quad jumper design from
TFA.
Which is great.
There was a few sequel trilogy sort of semi references, like that quad jumper was in that. We'll get to another one in a bit, but love these guys so much. From a mythical story arc perspective, entering space is always a threshold into a new phase of your journey in Star Wars. It takes you to a new location, right? You're entering into the literal unknown, which is the vast emptiness of space.
Yeah. And they've got, you know, new allies, which is fun. Like that sort of throws a wild card. It's like, yeah, they could end up anywhere. And, you know, they've got resources. Like these guys are going to help them in ways that we maybe don't anticipate yet. So that's kind of exciting. I think this episode is all about that threshold thing that you were just talking about, that moving from one space to a next.
Do you know what it is? It's
the image near the end, or
I mean, it's the threshold that when you are on your journey into the underworld or into the unknown, and you're faced with having to return home, right? Because once you actually leave the other world, the world by which you were transformed, which was the prison for Andor, right?
Yeah,
you have to go back and face reality with your new whatever you are. And many times, heroes kind of refuse to go home or are co-opted on the way and revert, do all sorts of crazy stuff, until often a feminine character, male heroes, and a feminine character reminds them of what they've needed all along, right? Why are they fighting for this? Sometimes in mythological stories, you'll get a gathering of allies at the last minute to fight the final contest, fight the final dragon, to prove the elixir to the community that you left behind. And can't you see that happening in the final episode?
Oh, yeah, definitely. We got like Saw Gerrera being pulled into the fold again. And just sort of everybody kind of going and having these little check-in conversations where, you know, like the Luthen's whole non-alliance is very sort of splintered and uneasy right now. But you can see where this Spellhouse Station or whatever they're calling it, you know, it's gonna pull a lot of people together, you know, and Ferrix as well. Like I imagine it's gonna be both things happening maybe at the finale.
Or we may get a mix of like the two things happening in succession, and like I feel like Ferrix is going to take the whole episode, but we'll see. You know, we get a brief Deirdre moment where she's like agreeing to the funeral because she wants to kind of pull them in, like set their trap, like this was a trap all along, maybe not realizing that this might be a reverse trap. And we kind of get that feeling of what's going on with how complicated everything is, with Cinta kind of running the like coffee shop across the street from where Marva lived. And also there's an Imperial spy that just hangs out in the coffee shop all day whispering into his lapel. Like,
right, right.
And it's like, okay, that's ridiculous. You guys are just since it's like this guy is like not subtle. Like
yeah.
Obviously you're ISB. I know who to shiv first, you know?
Like, yeah, yeah, no kidding.
No, but it's great that you also see the threshold aspect. Like, it feels that way. Like, it feels like there's about to become, you know, this calling home or whatever. And like, it's very scary to have to deal with the reality of what you've missed when you've been away on your transformational journey, which is he missed the death of his mother. Like, that's hard. That's hard stuff.
So the thing that really stuck out to me in this episode, and most of my notes are about this, is the near the end. So I'm kind of jumping ahead. But since you said what you just said, like the sun breaking through the clouds is just like the scene in Attack of the Clones when Anakin is like has woken up before Padme and he's standing out on the porch and like you just said, basically missing the death of his mother sort of. You know, it's that same, what are they called here? The crepuscular rays where, you know, you have like the bright and the dark sort of shining through the clouds. It's like a really similar image to Anakin in Attack of the Clones at the end of this episode where he's like sort of looking off to the skies. And again, yeah, it's like that same idea, like off on adventures. In Anakin's case, it was, you know, training to be a Jedi Knight and, you know, all that time was time that he sort of lost with his mother, so to speak. And yeah, Andor, I mean, it's a little different because she told him to go, you know.
No, but he still made the choice to like, you know, do what he did out of his own reasons, right? Like what his desires were rather than necessarily. And I want to be clear, it's important for at least psychologically these characters to leave home, you know, it is really important for us to see them go on their journeys as well. Also it mirrors, you know, the end of him looking off on the beach.
Right
Again, right? Like, so transformation is scary, all of these things, you know. When you go home, do you face death? That's a question, because anytime you pass through a threshold, death is always, you know, a consideration. You don't know what's going to face you on the other side and if you're able to survive with your who you are now. You know, it's the saying, you can never go home again. And it's because your home and you have changed.
Yep. I want to say too that like this image of the sort of like striped rays coming through the clouds in art, like the sort of, you know, black and white striped sun rays, like I think it appears often in like historical paintings of like battlefields, you know. So like, again, that notion that shit's about to hit the fan, people are probably gonna die. You know, that's, you know, like if you see paintings like that of like such and such war where they painted some famous battle, I think that's where, you know, those sort of rays appear in art a lot of the time.
And you know, they're called they're sort of called like heaven's rays sometimes. Like it always like evokes heaven and like the afterlife and that sort of concept.
Like at first I put like light of heaven in my notes and then I sort of looked it up, and like the actual proper name for them is like referring to like twilight, you know. So that notion of from day to night, night to day. And so
A threshold of sorts.
Kind of fun. I think we were thinking about a lot of similar things.
We get this amazing sort of scene between Vel and Clea. Like, you show up at my work. Like that was the attitude the entire time. She was so mad. Clea was just like, I'm done with you, Vel. Like, you know, Vel just wants to have a conversation with Luthen. She's literally been trying to find him since he left her on Aldani. Like, let me just talk to the boss. Let me just talk. No, you're you don't get to talk to the boss.
Yeah.
That was the conversation. Like, what talk
Bell's
about?
Like, I don't have time for your crap. I love it.
Middle management, you know, it's like,
yeah.
But she tells her about Cassian, and that's a major concern, right? Like, is Cassian still a problem? There is something that's enough to pull Cassian out into a trap, into a potential trap. And it's communicated in a non-direct, like, Cassian could come home for this. You know, it's just there. His mother died. Dot, dot, dot. You fill in the blanks, you know, and it's sort of it's the writing we've never had in Star Wars before, allowing the audience to fill in the blanks.
I love it. Yeah,
it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It felt very much like an episode of like Mad Men or something where, yeah, it's like, you know, all the drama here is just in these little like conversations of, you know, like micro conflict. Yeah, really, really good episode in that way, through the dialogue. Mm-hmm. I caught some interesting, like, there was, like, the Sentinel, like, the Jedi Temple Guard mask. I think that might have been new. I don't know if that was something, like, we had seen before, but I felt like that was a new addition, maybe.
We might have. They also showed, I saw in, like, some tweets, so RIP Twitter, there was Padme's like headdress, like so a Nubian one where she wore it on the way back in Attack of the Clones.
Yeah, and, like refugee ship. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So like that was in there. And like there's just been so many nice subtle like things in that shop that have been like fun to point out and look at. And there might even be like it would be really cool if there was like something in there from like Acolyte that we don't even know about.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, like that. And then people go back and be like, like some sort of like dark side, like cool artifact. Cause it's supposed to be kind of like that, right? I think that would just be a really cool way. And it's like the production staff, which is working on both things, is like, what if we put X in there? Or what if we put a version of X in there? And then people like go, and then like run it up the chain, and Dave Filoni's and Kathleen Kennedy are like, okay. And then they do.
Yeah. You do see like these old stone tablets and stuff.
Which were the hands, sort of right? From Rebels, right? Those were Mortis God's hands.
Yeah. It's like a lot of it that we recognize is like connoting the fall of the Republic, like the prequel trilogy. And like, of course, like you're going to have that, I guess, no matter what, because it's like, you know, Coruscant in that time period. But yeah, then you get sort of ancient stuff too, which is fun because of the High Republic sort of happening when it is, you know, the last couple, 2 years basically. So
it would be cool if there was stuff from the High Republic in there too. I don't know. I haven't been super caught up in all of the High Republic stuff, but yeah.
Same. Yeah. I read The Light of the Jedi and just like adored it so much. And then there's just been too many things to keep up with. But
You know, I think, you know, if the Acolyte sparks joy, it'll be a fun thing to dig into and
100%.
You know, find out all of the cool things, right? We get a brief, very brief questioning of Bix, who is off her rocker and not able to function.
This is a rough scene. Yeah.
If Anto Krieger is essentially Axis to the Empire, right? They're like, is this the guy? Looks nothing like Luthen, of course, right? But Anton Krieger, you know, hey, a rebels of all body types and shapes, and we got to respect that.
Yeah. We get the hologram image of him because we didn't have any sense of who he was before now. So
man with a plan.
Yeah. And her response is like nothing. Like she's just kind of lost in space right now. It's really hard to watch after all that awful interrogation torture stuff. But she doesn't really answer at all, does she? She just kind of doesn't react.
No, she sort of doesn't react, although they did threaten her with bringing back Dr. Gorscht, right? So and they just cut. I suspect she'll say she doesn't know this man, you know.
Yeah, something to stop the torture, yeah.
Yeah, or she'll say, yes, I do know this man. And then, you know, can you really trust admissions under torture? No.
Yeah, right.
And then we get this like amazing wine mum moment with Mon Mothma, who's watching her daughter participate in effectively like conservative club.
Yeah.
At her house.
I've seen this trope pop up like a few times in the last 10 years. I'm trying to remember where else I saw it. There was a movie of Daniel Craig, I think, where he's like the middle-aged dad and he's an atheist and his daughters have like become really religious because mm-hmm. that's just a way to rebel against the dad, you know. It's a similar kind of trope, I think.
Yeah.
You know.
Safe in the braid of the old ways. True and steady, braided in trust, the old ways hold us. Safe in the knot, in the binding, the old ways teach us. Bound against the wind, tied to the shore, tethered in permanence, safe in the braid of the old ways. Tethered in permanence, yielding in acceptance, safe in the braid of the old ways. True and steady and braided in trust, the old ways hold us. So that's the line that Lita says. Safe in the knot, in the binding, the old ways teach us. So it kind of continues in that like vibe of like nothing needs to change, right? So it's the chanting aspect of it. You know, ritual gives people a lot of sense of security and normality. And, you know, many of our sacred traditions across the world allow people to have a sense of security. And in a sense, this is an outward facing, you know, mantra / meditation, right? I'm trying to find a safe place. This place secures me. And it involves doing things in a way that has been traditionally done, right? We know the tradition has worked in the past. It should work for us in the future, right?
Yeah. Yep.
In some ways, traditions are really fine, right? Like they give us a sense of continuity and understanding of our past. The way that the traditions, though, sometimes don't work for people is what Val points out very quickly, which is you're not taking proposals, are you? So are all the traditions, are all of the things that are being said here good? Probably not. But many times when you get involved with something that pulls in teenagers like Christian youth group, right? Or, you know, certain activities, being all ultimately super puritanical online and policing other people's behaviors, right? Like teens look from a psychology perspective for a sense of control over their environment. And that's why they join groups that give them that sense of control. And is it or they do things online as part of a community where they feel part of a community that is giving them a sense of control. So this is just really, really important that you understand that this is just like a phase in life, right?
Yeah.
Is it feel very like, I don't know, extremist? Yeah, it feels a little extremist when we hear it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, seems to get along with the father more, like he's easygoing and there's not like that friction that she has with the mother. And he's the one who benefits from their arranged marriage, it seems, right? Like he's kind of like a house husband who just benefits from Mothma's
hang out with his friends clout. And
yeah, it seems like it. Yeah. And so, you know, from Lita's point of view, you know, you could see how she would be like, well, this tradition has served my dad well. And, you know, I want to be like him and easygoing and not struggle against the currents like my mother does or whatever, you know. So it's not hard to see how she would get there. But it is sort of like a conservative religious vibe that you're getting. It's so funny because
she found the elder. It's the only thing she shows up for on time.
And, oh, right.
You know, yeah. I also, you know, you're supposed to get this vibe that she's like Leia, right? Like
sure,
she has like hair that feels very Leia-like. you know, but she's almost like anti-Leia. Like, what happens to Leia when, oh, I don't know, her parents don't teach her all the right lessons because they're worried about stuff. Or maybe her mom is too busy working, you know, in the Senate. And her dad is kind of like, I just like my hobbies and my friends, right? Yeah. Well, my friend Lady V tweeted out this amazing thread, which who knows if it's still there. all about how when you see it presented, you get sort of an archetypical version of Mon Mothma, Vel, and Leia, almost echoing Leia, Luke, and Ben.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Right? Because Leia was always busy with the Senate. Perrin, Han, not responsible for anything, just a house husband. Yeah. You know, kind of a play around guy, right? What is he doing? Yeah. And Luke, this you know, family member that's always off on their adventures in the galaxy, comes home, brings, you know, interesting things. And in that situation, Ben ended up seeking an older mentor with, you know, the promise of control over his life.
And that guy is very Snoke-like, the 14-year-old's dad. He's very Snoke-like. That's so cool.
And like, you know, I really do think that teenagers will be caught up in finding mentors and older adults that help them feel like they have control over their environment, because they don't feel like they can get it at home, you know? And, and you might get that right with the teenager experience. And that's where you like get these like situations with like, you know, terrible youth pastors or like, you know, other things. Yep. It is what it is, right? Like you have to put up through all of the eye rolling and all of the phases and still be consistently there for your kids. It's a whole thing. And you have to care about what they care about, even if it's not for you. Yep.
It's rough. And yeah.
I loved how Mon Mothma, looking at Leia, said, I'm in so much trouble, not realizing that Leia's probably in so much trouble.
Right.
And she was referring to herself. And then she has that signed conversation with Vel about, well, this is how bad I'm in for it. You know, we found all these other problems. You know, now I have to fix it in this way. And I guess she's going to sell it her daughter, I guess.
Yeah, she's like catching Vel up on like stuff that's sort of old news to us. But we kind of are very much up to date on the bad things. Mm-hmm. Potentially coming down the line if well, the thing that was interesting to me was I jotted down in my notes, you know, she has a Padawan braid, like, you know, Anakin and Obi-Wan, what's the significance of this? And then the next like morning I was listening to your Willow podcast, and which is so funny, so like it connected all these dots for me, which you know, you read the chant that they were saying as part of the little prayer, and it really ties into what you said. But yes,
braids being like a bridge,
like a tether between two people. Yeah. So like, I guess in the prequel trilogy, it's sort of like a master apprentice tether, but
yeah,
you know, you sort of talked about like Rapunzel and love at first sight and things like that. And so I messaged you and I was like, so she's definitely going to fall in love with this really bad guy's son, like immediately. She's going to love him. And maybe maybe he's even a good kid. I mean, he's 14. So, you know, that's interesting, you know.
Yeah. It's very true that sometimes we turn out to be completely the opposite of our parents. And we fight very hard to not be like them.
Yeah.
Right.
I think so. And yeah, I mean, I mentioned the thing earlier about like the, you know, the children being conservative as a reaction to their parents, like liberalism or leftism or whatever. And I once had a college professor that I really liked. He sort of said, like, you know, you have a tendency to just try to be the opposite of what your parents are, you know. And so
like this kid could be like a genuinely good kid.
I think he's going to be a good kid and we're going to really like him. And it's just the fact that his father is real bad news. And it's just that messy tangle of, you know, kind of like Game of Thrones did a good job of that, where like, you know, you might like the prince, but then the parents are like the worst people in the realms or whatever. So it's just the politics of the family that are the threat more than the kid or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. So that sort of like wraps up that scene. We don't really come back to the Mon Mothma household at all. We get this brief, ever so brief, non-hollow, but like a straight up wall communication of Mosk. So Sergeant Mosk calling Cyril, being like, I'm still loyal, sir. I've got some information. Like not knowing that Cyril's now like a digital paper pusher, you know, and he's like, he lets him know through kind of the interruptions and what's going on in his environment, that there is a funeral for Cassian Andor's mom on Ferrix. And of course, this is like our thread to pull Cyril in to come to Ferrix at the right time for everything to go down. Of course, Deirdre's going to come too, right? She's going to be like, I'm going to be there. I'm going to make the arrest, you know? Like, it's all going
to... Everybody wants to catch the same fish. He's important.
And he's very slippery, so he won't be caught, which is good. I really love this moment because we get another moment of like his terrible mother.
She's not the most lovable, but
And later on in the episode, we see a brief, you know, she's left for the day. So he sneaks back in and steals all her money because, of course, he's going to Ferrix. Right. Like that's I don't think I need to bring that up later when it actually happens. It's. He sneaks back in and he's got his funds and, you know, he's going to get fired from his job unless he submitted the 16 pieces of paperwork to take leave. You know, we get Cassian finally dropped off and how they do it. We hear the snoring and he's like in the hotel room, like he's stuck into the hotel room to get his box back that he hid so well in the shower.
It's like his little Jason Bourne lockbox of like, here's my identity and my gun and my money and all this.
And his Nemec treatise, which we hear finally. Yeah. And I was like, yes, we actually got to hear it, which means he will have listened to it at some point. That like, we're not going to have to actually hear Nemec tell us the whole treatise, but we may get before the end of the whole show a clip of the treatise.
Yeah, I hope so. I think that'd be cool.
Which is so cool. And so he sneaks on out with his lockbox. Just super spy, like, yeah, like you're right, like we could have gotten this in a Jason Bourne movie. You know,
yeah like it would have been in like a bank safety deposit box normally. But instead it's just in this random Miami hotel.
Exactly. And then we get at Saw's, you know, outfit, Luthen showing up, and Saw's just like jazzed. I feel like Saw has like big manic energy half the time and big depressive energy half the time. Like he's like, I'm in on Spellhouse, but I want all these things, and I want to be in control of the plan, and I want this, and I want that. And like Luthen's like literally like, it's like 3 seconds to go time. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, and the scene is so good.
It's great. Yeah, it's sort of like he wants to make all these demands, and Luthen is very good at like maintaining control. He knows how to manipulate people at like the drop of a hat, and he just sort of this is where he points his blaster at somebody, right? And then he sort of like says Two Tubes is like his man on the inside, because Saw is like completely paranoid and just thinks like, you know, he's got eyes and ears everywhere. Which indeed he does.
He does.
So
yeah,
it's one of those cases where Saw is kind of extremely paranoid, as we saw in Rogue One. But it might be a case where he may become that very paranoid person in Rogue One because of what happens in this finale. I feel like the next episode, like he, I don't know. I get that feeling.
Yeah.
Like when Jyn Erso comes to like see him, you know, and like ask for his help or whatever in Rogue One. I don't remember all the fine details, but he's just like, they sent you here to kill me. How did you get there, man? That was quite a leap that you just made. But
I mean, there's like Saw is just is so such an interesting character because they do a really good job of connecting him to the original Clone Wars character, which is I didn't think that would be possible with what we saw in Rogue One, but like he really does feel that way, like not trustworthy, and like all of his flaws sort of echo and grow with time. Like it's really, really cool that they've managed to maintain this character in such a robust way across all of the time that they've had. They've had less luck with other characters in the franchise. I'm just going to say that.
That's probably fair.
It's shocking to Saw. Like, Luthen, you're willing to burn Krieger, you know? And it's like, well, you know, Krieger is not a threat to me. He doesn't know who I am. You're a threat, so I have to protect you. Like, that's your assurance, Saw. But I want you to decide what we do. Right. You decide if you go. And truthfully, I think this is like Luthen kind of head versus heart situation.
Having a conscience. Yeah.
Right. Like he.
I think so, too.
He wants Saw to actually go and protect Krieger or he wouldn't have shown up. He would have just said it's too late. He wouldn't have shown up himself to have this discussion and truthfully say, like, you know, are you in the dark side with me or can we actually do something that is actually the light? Like, can we go and do the right thing? Am I too far gone down this path to not save an ally?
Yeah. I think when I was thinking about that sort of threshold, like the sun image and, you know, the night and day thing, I was thinking about Luthen's whole sacrifice deal and how kind of like Andor like finds ways to synthesize the things that Luthen claims that like a rebel can't have, right? Like Andor ends up kind of being like a joyful, like loving person by the end, by the time of his death. And I like the idea here that something got through to Luthen and he's like, you know, just sort of like he doesn't want to make that call because the cold calculating, you know, spy master part of him knows like, yeah, he could just let these people die, but instead he's, you know, letting someone who's more sort of emotionally driven kind of make the call, which is cool.
Yeah.
He sort of knows where his weakness is almost. Yeah, he's very self-aware.
Like, he's like, I need somebody else with a heart to actually care about this because this is wrong. Yeah.
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 He's like, look, I'm dead inside, man.
I need you to make the call on this one. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, he even does like a very cruel and calculating thing to get Saw's attention in his panic. You know, he blames Tubes, who's his like trusted ally, just to get his attention, which is amazing, you know, and so gray in its wondrousness. You know, following up on this, Luthen leaves. We don't know the answer, right? We don't know what's going on. And they have this like amazing coded conversation. It reminds me a lot of Baroness Orksi's Scarlet Pimpernel and how Scarlet Pimpernel would communicate with his allies in public as the foppish character in, you know, the courts of London, in the royal courts, and trying to explain how they were going to go against the French, you know, what was happening in French with the, you know, the Republic and, of course, the death of all the royals, right? So trying to go and save people from the guillotine. He would talk in sort of coded communication with people. And, you know, we're worried about losing the peace. Oh, it's a crowded market. You'll just make things more complicated. You know, like talking about Cassian and the other things that are happening in this code that sort of talks about people as priceless artifacts. Sort of wonderful.
It's cool, yeah, because it like ties back to the way Luthen treats Cassian, like when they first meet, mm-hmm. like this idea that he sees something in him that most people wouldn't see, and he's special, which is kind of how collectors are, you know, collectors can tell authenticity and, you know, history at kind of a glance in ways that, you know, somebody who's collected Superman comics for 40 years is going to be able to tell you a lot about like a Superman comic if you hand it to him, as opposed to, you know, me, who's not like a big Superman guy, you know? And so, yeah, like Luthen's sort of like a rebel to the core, and he understands Andor, you know, in this like sort of supernatural way that Andor doesn't even, almost like a psychological profile thing, but also that mythic hero quality too, I think. Yeah.
You're like a difference maker. Like there's a certain they talk about Campbell talks about people who are on their own journey and are obviously going to be kind of bucking against what society wants and are change enablers, as they have kind of a different aura about them. You kind of notice them. You're like, oh my God, this is a special person. This person is going to do something, mm-hmm. you know? And it's because they're swimming against the stream, right? They're going mm-hmm. in a different direction. They're going in their own path and they are following their own way. And when you can kind of see that in people, it's almost like they have a different energy about them, mm-hmm. you know, their vibes. and yeah, Luthen sees that in people very easily, right? This person, this Andor, this Cassian Andor is a unique fellow, right? He's got a lot going on. Mm-hmm. And they get cut off by an Imperial ship. You know, and I think I made a joke like when we were watching this, my husband and I, Kyle, a communication disruption can only mean one thing, invasion, you know, because yeah. you know exactly what's going on as soon as their communication shut off.
Yeah, this is that big, what, Corvette thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like the with the dishes, mm-hmm. that old design, like unused design.
Yeah, I think it showed up in maybe one of the West End Games role-playing games books, because I know they like to pull things from there. I think it showed up in Rebels.
Rebels, yeah, that was what I was going to say. Yes, yeah, I was thinking.
Yeah.
Rebels love to use unused things and bring them in, finally. I love that.
And, you know, they're just like, we're just scanning codes because this is a, you know, sector of pirates, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, can't communicate right now, trying to do the thing. Yeah. And he has a whole plan prepped before they even get him.
Yeah.
He knows what they're going to do.
I loved the sort of insight too, in like the police procedure, how like these guys know, quote unquote, I mean, obviously he is like the danger that they're looking for, but they think he's like totally harmless, but they're like, yeah, we could use the practice, like that idea that cops just harass people because they can, essentially. I thought the guy performing the commander, the captain on deck, like he was really good at being a total like slime ball.
Yeah, exactly. and then so he goes through his plan of like very methodically, this is how you escape an Imperial ship. Didn't you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it occurs to me in this moment that it's kind of like the Spaceballs thing where they jam the radar dish. You know, he sort of jams the with his
his countermeasures. If that's what they were referring to or thought of when they came up with this, bravo. I love it.
Yeah, I really hope that was intentional, but maybe not.
And they release, you know, the air support, they release the TIE fighters, and he fights them off very easily and does a lot of sort of similar moves. And this is the second, sort of sequel trilogy reference that I sort of see, which is how he flies his ship and the two red beams. Like, it just reminded me so much of Kylo's ship in TLJ.
Yeah, the second space battle where Leia gets shot out into space. Yeah, I 100% agree. The way he kind of, definitely the way he flies really like aggressively and
Yeah, and then like straight up has laser beams that look like lightsabers, like red side lightsabers. Like what?
Yeah, like a cross guard for his ship.
Yeah, I was like,
Sleuthin Kylo.
At least in red. Yeah, no, but it had that vibe, and it like this has been the first sort of mini scuffle we've had in space.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
Since just like the little escape through the atmosphere from the Aldani thing, but that was like more just like a car chase. Yeah, this was cool. TIE fighters looked really great.
Luthen ship, the U-wing looked amazing.
Yeah, like there's sort of these like solid beams. Definitely, yeah, had that like turbo laser lightsaber vibe.
And he did the spin. Spinning is good.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Which is, yeah. The so Anakin good. Kylo move. Yeah.
Yeah.
So good.
Cassian calls home, which we only see from like the person on Ferrix's perspective. And you see his reaction. He's like, tell Marva I'm okay. And I'm on my, you know, and he's like, no, dude, like your mother has died. There's a funeral. Like, yeah. He doesn't tell him to stay away either, which is really, really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like he's very like informed on like that it would be, you know. It's interesting. Yeah.
It certainly makes me feel like if there was a town conspiracy against the Empire, they would warn him away.
Oh, right. Sure. Yeah.
Like, oh, this is fake, dude. Stay away. You know, it definitely feels real. Like, I'm sorry, dude. Your mother is now has joined the wall.
Yeah. 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 Which is like a beautiful like process that they do. And apparently that's like a thing in real life, like the bricking. Oh. Like that's apparently that happens some places. Like, I don't think it's a widespread thing at all, but I think it I found like a couple sites talking about stuff like that where people were cremated into stone, or like there's like a pyramid in some town where they brick people into a pyramid and stuff like that. So.
Oh, that's really interesting. I know it's more recent. You can actually get turned into like the ash that, and then like a tree is planted.
Yeah, I like that stuff. That. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've heard about the tree stuff. Yeah, that's cool. I don't know. It's really heartbreaking. He says like, you know, tell her I did this and this and she'd be proud of me. Just tell her that. And it's like, oh man.
Cassian.
You know. But, you know, it's good that he's, you know, feels that way. That's the way he needs to feel to be a hero. He's doing the right thing. And, you know, he's right. I think, you know, he's got that.
He's on the right path. He's heading home. But things always change, right? When you go in your
right. Family. Right. Yeah.
The world that you left is a darker one without you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even if you had to leave, he comes out from his phone call. And joins Melchi on the beach, and Melchi says, "Everything okay?" And Anders like, "Yeah, it's fine." He lies, of course, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, did Cassian ever tell him his real name? ? Who knows? How many of us made it? What if it was just us? We need to split up. People have to know what's going on. So my takeaway from this is that Melchi understands the elixir, that we need to work together and we need to tell people about this injustice so that it's not just us, right? So this is the manifestation of spreading the elixir to the community so that the community can learn from it and benefit from it. And mm-hmm. Melchi's there, but now Cassian has been sidelined by the funeral. And needs to go on more trials to end up where he needs to be.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like almost like they emerge from being like, you know, these sort of prisoners, you know, scrabbling out of the prison to being like almost priestly or something, like, like prophets. Like, we got to tell people, you know, if we work together, we can make shit happen. And I like the idea of Melchi being that figure, you know, even if Andor can't right now. So I imagine him going off and gathering, you know, a bunch of rebels, which is cool. get more of those like Rogue One characters in season two to show up, maybe. Or
yeah, I mean, we know we're gonna get K2SO, so
yeah, definitely.
Alan Tudyk incoming. I want nothing more than K2SO time, all of it. I want all of the time. Yeah, I love him so much. So yeah, that ends the episode with Andor staring off into the sunset, the threshold of where he's going to be, right? What else does he have to go through? And I want to say, like, just because Cassian is returning home with an elixir doesn't mean that's the end of a journey. He could very well go immediately back into a different journey of transformation. And there's a different story to tell, and it has to do with K2SO and him becoming a king, right? A leader, a truthful leader. He let Andy Serkis's character, Kino Loy, lead the rebellion.
Right. Yep.
And Cassian has yet to step into the role of his own power in the rebellion.
Yeah. That like confident, like Han Solo swagger that he has in Rogue One. Yeah.
He's not there, right? So he's gonna go through a complete arc journey in season two as well. And going through similar symbolic archetypical processes, but the lesson that he learns and the transformation that he goes through is a different experience.
Yeah. I'm also thinking about how like Bix has transformed over the course of the season. I'm wondering how she fits into this big picture, because she was, you know, sort of like very happy and secure and like, you know, like fulfilled in life. We sort of meet her, and then like after Cassian like goes off on his Aldani adventure, you know, she's sort of like picking up the wreckage of his whole sort of inciting incident with the, you know, basically the cops, so to speak. And then, you know, now she's just like, you know, just kind of like lost her voice and her power and all that stuff. So I'm curious to see, you know, if she becomes sort of inspired by him, or if if she becomes sort of like the new, like, yeah, the queen of Ferrix, the daughter of Ferrix, you know.
I do think that's where we're heading. Or at least that's what I hope to see, right? I hope to see Bix, in a way, she's experiencing an underworld trial of her own, right? She's neither alive nor dead to the people on the outside of the building.
And, sure, yeah.
Has, through the seeds, through the wisdom of Marva, the ability to transform potentially, right? So it will be interesting to see what we see. I've been very happy with the writing of the female characters in this, and it shows a couple of things that I'll probably go into more next episode. But Joey Salloway talks about how you do feminine gaze, and it involves sort of some key things, which is one of them, and kind of the top, other than, you know, mythical archetypal journeys, right? That experiencing internal transformations is the feeling camera. When people are experiencing emotions in this show, the camera stays with them, and we, as the audience, feel those emotions with the characters on screen. If they are broken, we see that. If they are angry, we see that. If they are in love, we see that, right? We saw that with Vel, right? Or not with Vel, we see that with, you know, Bix. That's a really, really important thing to truthfully experience a whole person through the camera. And I'm so happy that we're getting that in this show. And that's props to the directors of these amazing episodes, that's been a focus to actually do and not quickly cut away, because the experience that the character is going through is not as valuable as the action.
It's like, as we got a valuable little of that in Obi-Wan, but definitely in this show, it's like, it's more of like a braver type, like let's let these be you know, human beings, mm-hmm. like, basically. And like, you know, react to things the way that we might. And it's fresh and shocking. And yeah, people are kind of like, wow, like this is, you know, it's definitely a different approach to Star Wars for some people, but you know, a lot of the message is the same, ultimately, which is fun.
It absolutely is. The message is the same. Yeah, it's just,
I think so,
more complex because the characters on screen show their dirtiness, show the mm-hmm. grittiness, show the dirt under their fingernails.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that wraps up episode 11. One more before the season finale, and only 13 more in this series. And it's really just doing so much for Star Wars, and it's doing so much for television, and it's doing a lot for me too.
yeah, it's very good. It's been an unexpected treasure for sure. Yeah, just mm-hmm. you know, yeah, you always hope to enjoy a Star Wars thing when you've loved Star Wars for so many years, but it's like, it's really, really special.
So Alex, where can people find you if they're looking for you?
That's a good question. Yeah, we're gonna find out if Twitter still exists, you know, this week and next week. But yeah, I'm all over the place on Tumblr. I'm End Poem, which is like a Minecraft reference from years ago. Where there's you know, I'm on Mastodon. I think I'm Alex James Kane there. I'm like,
oh, a Alex link James. To your link tree.
Yeah. Yes. You can find me. I'm not hard to find.
All of Alex's links will be in the liner notes, so you can check that out. And we look forward to having you back for next episode, the end of the season. Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to What the Force. I'm Marie-Claire Gould, your host. Our music is provided by Christy Carew for What the Force. We have a Patreon at patreon.com/whattheforce. We would like to thank all our patrons, especially those who love and are obsessed with What the Force. Cheryl, Melody, Night Huntress, In Wild Space, How Rude, Anna Perez, Neil, Joe Allen D, Christian Luca, Josh Johnson, Scott C, and Susan. Make sure to like and subscribe on YouTube or leave a 5-star review on iTunes or other pod apps. It helps people find the show. Check out our other channel on YouTube, What the Fiction. You can connect with us on Twitter at WTForceShow, What the Force Podcast on Facebook, and our website, whattheforce.ca. We also have a Discord. Links are in the liner notes. Feel free to reach out and start a conversation. Cheers.